This podcast is in no way affiliated with the upcoming production or Deborah Harkness. All views expressed are solely our own.
It begins with absence and desire. It begins with blood and fear. It begins with the discovery of witches.
Welcome to episode 22 of the All Souls podcast. I'm Ginger.
And I'm Summer.
So every once in a while, Summer and I have the opportunity to not just discuss the book or the show that we're following along, but also to interview people and creators who are part of the process, part of bringing us the magic, especially behind adaptation. And one of the creators, one of the pieces of the puzzle that is brought forth, but often, if not overlooked, often someone that you don't necessarily think about. And maybe sometimes that's natural because it's so beautifully woven in. And that is the screen and film composer. Today, Summer and I have the absolute pleasure of welcoming Mr. Rob Lane, who is the film and TV composer for A Discovery of Witches on Sky One. Thank you so much, Mr. Rob Lane, for joining us.
That's a pleasure. Hello, how are you?
We're doing well. We were just talking about how you're in sunny Brighton, and it's bright there.
It is. It's sunny.
Is it really hot or just a little bit warm?
No, it's actually genuinely very sunny. You get lovely sea kind of weather down here. It can be quite fierce or it can be just beautifully blue. Part of the time I love living down here is half the time I feel like I'm on holiday. So.
Oh, there you go. It goes between mild winters, sometimes rainy spring, mm-hmm. and then just watch out furnace blast heat in the summer. It's not fun.
Yeah.
Oh, my goodness. Okay, so before we actually get to A Discovery of Witches and your experience with composing the score or something that maybe was unique with this show, we would like to know and would like our listeners to know, what is your background? How did you know from what age that you wanted, number one, that you were musical.
Mm-hmm.
And then what did that lead into training-wise, college, school, uni-wise? And then once you were getting training, how did you even know? How does one become a film and TV composer?
Well, this is a big, big question. So for me, my mum was a music therapist in that she uses therapy to work with people with handicaps and educational learning difficulties and so on. My dad was a cellist. So I came from a pretty musical family where people learned instruments. And, you know, that kind of classical training was something that was encouraged. And so from 9 years old, I played the clarinet. And from 11 years old, I played the piano. Clarinet, I got quite good on by my mid-teens. And around 16, I kind of thought I'd like to be a professional clarinet player. And I very briefly played in the National Youth Orchestra in England. But I discovered that it was quite a moment for me because I discovered that I was number 8 of 10 clarinets and only 3 of them were the real, you know, top players who were going to play in the proms. The rest of us were there for kind of training. And it was quite a moment because I realized basically that I was going to be meeting these people at every audition for every music school or orchestra, and they were all going to be better. So I kind of put the music, ambition on hold, and I went to university and did an English degree. But all the time throughout this period, I was also playing in bands from about 14. In fact, I'd say I played in bands from 14 to 26. So I was kind of, I had this kind of mixture of playing in all sorts of different bands, funk, rock, all sorts of stuff. But I had this classical background when I was, I kind of got interested in jazz at university. So I had these different kind of musical loves going on that you know, I was really into, and not expecting, wondering basically, would I be in a band? Would the band that I was in, would it get anywhere? And basically, it got as far as getting a publishing deal. And at the age of 26, somebody said to me, the producer of the band said to me, took me aside, and he said, "Rob, your band, I don't think is going to quite make it. I can't quite see it happening. And one of the reasons is because you're just too chameleon. You're just ducking and diving. In 1 week you're doing soul and funk, and next minute you're expressing an interest in jazz and world music and so on. But you know, that's the reason I don't think you're going to succeed in this band. But you might be. Have you ever considered media music? Have you ever considered writing for TV and film?" And I remembered, actually, literally, it was like one of those moments, a light bulb went on and I realized, yes, that's what I'm supposed to do. So at the ripe old age of 27, having done classical music, played in jazz bands, played in funk bands, I decided to go back to school and do a 3-year postgraduate course at the National Film and TV School. Which basically taught you the basics taught you the sort of technical stuff of writing for film and TV, and gave you a studio to basically live in and, you know, and do lots of student films. I did about 30 student films while I was there. And one of the directors that I worked with early on employed me for a very short 10-minute film. And he then got a feature film together called The Young Poisoner's Handbook, all the way back in 1994. And because I did that at film school, people were interested in what I was doing, and I got an agent straight out of film school who then, a couple of key interviews got my career going. So I kind of basically found, after a crisis of, where I had to kind of let go of the band dream, as it were, I kind of one door closed and another opened, and that's how I got into. I suddenly discovered what I wanted to do, which was do this. And so, you know, being 27, I went to film school with a fairly messianic impulse to be successful. I went there thinking I can't afford to do 3 more years of education and it not come to anything. So I made sure it did come to something.
I think you're right. I think it definitely did come to something.
Yeah. Well, I mean. I started off writing, you know, you're basically looking for contacts in any way, you know. You've got to be good at writing film and TV music. You've got to have the technical sort of stuff down increasingly now, you know. You've got to be able to demonstrate your work on computer and samples and so on. But you've also got to have some kind of ability to get to know people and kind of develop contacts, you know. I mean, what I do is entirely dependent on my contacts. You know, the great film composers, generally you will look at them and they will have great directors that they work with. You know, if you think of Spielberg and John Williams, or you think of Alfred Hitchcock and Bernard Herrmann, you know, you do your best work in collaboration with other people. So it's your career kind of rises and falls and ebbs and flows based on the contacts that you have and whether people are coming back to you, you know, for another gig. Composers in film and TV, it's all about developing contacts of people that like your work and will come back to you. And it's about building those kind of relationships and sustaining them. And, you know, when we come and talk to about it, this is partly why I got this job or was even interviewed for it at the beginning. So there's lots of ways into film and TV music. People do, you know, you have people come in from bands, increasingly like Johnny Greenwood of Radiohead has made a massive impact through his work with Paul Thomas Anderson. You've got people that went to film school, you've got people that have come in from theatre. There's no specific obvious direct route in. You know, it sort of happens for some people and it doesn't happen for others.
Perfect. That's exactly what we wanted to hear. I think you're the second composer we've spoken with. The other was Bear McCreary.
Oh, yeah, Bear. Yeah.
Yeah, behind the Outlander series. And he, of course, has a different entree into it. Thank you for sharing that, because it's so interesting to hear all the different ways that this path can find you, or that you can find that path.
Yeah, I mean, a lot of people will obviously, you know, a lot of people will go to film school. And, you know, maybe if you're lucky, one or two of the directors that you work with will work. and get a chance to employ you. And then it's, and then hopefully the work starts to speak a bit more for itself. You know, it's like the people that tend to do well tend to come in with a sort of particular sound or voice that is of the moment, that is quite timely, and it just seems to be a fresh voice. And if they get the chance to do good work for a good show, you know, everybody will think they're cool and they'll get loads more gigs. And that's how the relationship is. That's how the career is built up. You know, you could have a career with just working with one director once a year, or you could have a career by working with five or six different directors, you know, once every 3 or 4 years. Some directors in the business always seem to pick a new director. I'm sorry, a new composer. They just like working with new people. Other people tend to go for this for loyalty and the benefits of a shorthand, you know, with people. So, I mean, there are two or three directors that I work with five to, I think the most I worked with somebody was eight times. And then there are other directors that, you know, are just kind of going to, you know, you're grateful that you've got this gig with them, but they're probably going to choose somebody different the next time.
Well, speaking of that gig, the job that you're hired to do, we are always interested in the creative process of musicians and all the artists, any type of artist. When you have that next job, have that next score to compose, and you sit down, we're presuming with the episode, at least some kind of final or nearly final cut, your job is to bring that musical support, the atmospheric support. How do you even start? Do you hear melodies once you've been inspired by a scene, or do you begin to compose and then become inspired to continue?
I mean, probably mostly you see the picture and you start bar one, you know, you sync up your picture with the computer and you literally start playing stuff through your keyboard. In my case, you know, you've got your keyboard is triggering lots of different samples and you think to yourself, oh, should this start with a string sound or should this start with a piano or whatever? You literally like just make the first gesture. And then it's a constant kind of reflecting on the process of, you know, is that working? Did that bring that out? It's a really mysterious kind of alchemy, you know, which is a lot of the time. I think. Well, it is, funnily enough. It's kind of like, it's a good word for this. I'm a good word for this show, you know, because it is a sort of weirdly instinctive, I describe it as kind of failing upwards type of thing where, you know, you try and get a cue together and then you'll play it to the director and they'll say, oh, I like that, or no, that's not working for me. That's what they often say at the beginning. No, that's not working for me. I wanted it to be more like this. And then you reflect on that and you come back with something else. So, you know, it might be like somebody says, oh, that's too... I mean, you know, in real simplistic terms, they might say, oh, it's too sad, or it's too positive, or it's too drummy, or it's too rhythmic. And what it ends up being is this kind of negotiation between what's going on in your head and what's going on in their heads. And a lot of the time they don't know what they want, but they know what perhaps they don't want, you know? So what it tends to be is that you've got various things which sort of limit your, which start to help you define your thoughts. So, you know, a lot of the time, virtually all the time, editors in the production process rely on what we call temp music to work with. You know, the days of an editor just literally sitting there with a picture, putting a picture together, just very rarely happens. You know, they are from the off. They are kind of putting in bits of music from film scores they know, they like, and they're working to try and create this kind of alchemy between music and picture. And so their thoughts are then, you know, when you come to a show, often it does have temp music on it, and you're trying to work out what is it that they like about this, what is it that seems to be working, and then how can I then work with that, but then bring something new to it, something that the temp isn't doing, you know. So, you know, in the case of Discovery of Witches, you know, the there was quite a lot of conversation about what the temps meant, you know. Maybe without going into specific scores, you know, there were a couple of scores that the director, the first director and the editor particularly worked with, and that were, which they used to tell me, this is indicative of the kind of thing I'm hearing. But then, you know, a producer might then say, but that's not indicative of what I'm hearing. I don't like that. So then you get told, you know, and then the first thing that was said to me was, no Harry Potter. It's like, well, what do you mean? You mean, what does no Harry Potter mean? Well, what it means is no twinkly Celestes. You know, like if you think of that starts with an instrument we call the Celeste, yeah, which is a sort of a small piano that sounds tinkly, lovely, famously used by Tchaikovsky in the Dance of the Sugar Plum Fairy. Okay, so the first thing that the producer said to me was no Celestes. I don't want it to sound like Harry Potter. So that's sort of beginning to, and then they would say things like, I don't like high strings either. So then you're going, okay, all right, so we want something without Celeste that's kind of in the cello range or kind of, you know. And so what they're doing is they are slightly defining the box that you're working in, and you're trying to keep the box as open as possible. You're trying to interest them, in fact, in a new box. And they're often kind of like needing some kind of cajoling to see, they may have got used to something that's happening in the temp music, and you've got to try and get them to sort of think of something new, because out of professional pride and out of artistic endeavor, you want to try and bring something new to it. So, you know, but having said that, the temp can be quite instructive. Like one of the temps that they put in there was a very electronic sounding score, you know, and it gave me some thoughts about, not that I, you know, that I, oh, I want to do exactly that, but it showed to me that certain electronic gestures could kind of work, and particularly in the music for Sartu in episode one, you know, where they go and hunt her and she dispatches the huntsman. I mean, you know, the temp music suggested things to me, like using processed chimes and weird kind of elemental sounds that were completely different from the temp, but they took me in a new, it actually helped me to do something quite new. But then that was in the brief of already having discussed it, and they said, yeah, we think that when you go to Finland, it should sound very elemental. It should feel like the sound is growing out of the earth. You know, so it's a mixture of brief and conversations and temps and your own painful efforts, and then reflecting on those efforts, and until you start to get something that people like. You know, I took me a long time to get there. And also the other problem is that the cut is always changing a lot at the beginning. So you might get something, you think, oh, fantastic, I've got the music to sit right in this cut. And then you discover that they've taken 10 seconds out of it, you know, or something. And so suddenly the cue doesn't work anymore and has to be redone. So it's a difficult process of trying to kind of get people to agree and to gradually kind of evolve the music to something that works. And it's funny when you watch other people's scores, you know, and you watch your own score at the end when it's finally done and finished and mixed and recorded, and you go, cause it's slightly a miracle that it sort of works. You know, it's like, wow, it looks so easy, but in fact, it wasn't at all.
It's funny you mention electronic because, and them not wanting strings or high strings, because one of my favorite songs is Separation Brings the Witch Rain, which starts very electronic and kind of gradually builds to higher strings. And I think it's one of the few songs that features the higher strings segment. And it's my favorite, but I love it.
Oh, thank you. Thank you.
But I love the gradual moving from the electronic sound into the more, you know, organic string sound. So
yeah, absolutely. And that evolves because, you know, because somebody has said, well, look, how do we do, you know, one of the things in that, in the section in episode four, where they start to fall in love, you know, people again are sort of trying stuff out and they're trying different things. And okay, I hope it doesn't spoil it for you, but you know, some of Interstellar was on that on there, and you know, Hans Zimmer score for Interstellar, and it became an interesting thing of like, you know, they go for that horse ride, and then he says, "I'm falling for you," and they kiss, and then at the end, the witch rain comes along, and in both cases, they use the same piece. And the big thing about that score is the use of organ, you know, what felt really good about that was, you know, the sense that something huge and cosmic and something is opening up in these moments, and it's getting very kind of, you know, the rain is swirling everywhere. So I wanted something something swirly that sort of said particles in space are kind of rushing around them, and it's getting sort of spiritually exciting for them at that moment. But then also, it's got to have the kind of warmth and yearning of romantic strings, to be honest. It's got to have the power that sort of just string harmony can develop. I mean, if the organ was just on its own there, it would sound a bit Philip Glassy. It would sound a bit like Koinesquatsy or so on. It wouldn't have the emotional impact. So there's the organ in there. There's the developing strings, which are very Baroque in their kind of in their harmony. And then towards the end, the choir comes in, and so on. So it's a big build, and it's also, as you said, it's got the electronic stuff in there as well. So it's the kind of cue evolved to that with discussions that had a temp, which is a pretty fearsome temp if you think of Hans Zimmer's score for Interstellar. You know, it's a world famous score. So you're sort of thinking, how can I do that? How can I capture something of the grandeur of that, but not do the same? That's a crucial thing. You know, it's a bit like when Ashmole 782, you know, burns itself into her hand. It's like it's like a palimpsest, isn't it? It's like there's the residue of like other pictures of other words under the page. Well, think of it like that for the musician. It's like there's the residue of the temp that they've used, you know, that they've grown to love, and then you come along and you need to do something different. You need to do something, and you know, and somehow you've got to kind of develop enough new stuff that kind of feels like that could only have been written for that scene.
Before we ask the next question, I just have to say it's the building of those strings. And I understand there are different time periods. There are different, obviously, composers. I listened to the soundtrack, but Summer pointed that one out because she got ahead of me. I went straight to that one. And oh my gosh, it caused both of us to weep in privacy.
Oh, good.
But it was so beautiful. And the thing it reminded me of, not directly, but because of the swell and the building of those strings, was Samuel Barber's Adagio for Strings.
Which is one of my favorite pieces, and you know, like, yeah, I'm glad that it's not an explicit reference to me, but it's part of my, certainly part, it's in there in my emotional vocabulary, if you like, because what you're trying to dig out of you know what I've tried to do as a composer trying to learn how to write music is I've obviously studied pieces like that. And you try. I remember spending 2 days writing out or reducing the whole of Samuel Barber's Adagio for Strings to a piano part that I could play, because I wanted to understand what it was in the harmony that I loved. What was really making me give me those kind of goosebumps, that sense of it. And you know, it's like you have those become part of your emotional repertoire, if you like. I could say tricks of the trade, but it's much more profound than that. It's like I sort of tend to go after music like that and then try to understand it, and then you kind of build it into your emotional repertoire, and then you find it coming out just when you need it, when you think, Jesus, I've got this temp, which is Interstellar, which is sounding fantastic. What else have I got that I could do differently? Well, the answer is I've got some Baroque changes. I've got some sort of Samuel Barber-ish type harmony that is just in me, that becomes my response to this. But it's also, it becomes my response because I have to come up with something new. Otherwise, I'm just copying the temp, you know, and no one wants to do that. And this has been very explicit about what composers actually feel when they write stuff. But it is actually the truth in film and TV music, because there is always the imprint of a previous bit of music, virtually always. I can only think of one job that I did where the editor decided to use no music.
You're like, but I wrote this thing. And he's like, sorry.
Well, no, sorry. What I mean was they used no temp music
to color it.
Because what editors are trying to do and directors are trying to do in TV and film is that they are trying to sell their cut to the executives who are financing the film. And the executives cannot see, they can't do a test screening, they can't do a test screening for audiences without music, because music is anywhere between 20% and 50% of the experience. Yeah, you know, it colors how you feel about the pacing, it colors how you feel about the emotion, whether a scene is working or not. Sometimes the music is band-aiding scenes that don't work. You know, so the bottom line is that the editing process is very dependent these days on using music. And so inevitably, when you come to compose your own music, there's the imprint of what the director and the editor feel about that music. And it's difficult because fundamentally you want to come up with something new, but it's almost like it's not so much coming up with something new as evolving away from what was there before.
So it sounds like not just your job, obviously, is to do the composing, but it's that they feed you something that gives you the color of, or the, like, as you said, it gives you an imprint of what they're looking for-ish for a scene, and you're evolving away from it. At the same time, they're going to go hear that next cut and go, or maybe go, eh. And so is it kind of like it's a back and forth?
It's totally a back and forth. And what's interesting is if you think about it, when I think about the opening cue, I did the opening kept on changing. It took ages for them to actually come up with the concept of it begins with absence, bang. It begins with da 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 da, bang. You know, the actual thing of having the title cards came about, you know, 6 weeks or so into the edit. So I had to, you know, I had to get that sorted out. Actually, the editor helped me with that. We decided on a rhythm that would kind of work for those cards, and then for some reason in somewhere I came up with this 4-note bass line that you hear when Matthew ever says at the beginning, when he describes the world and how the creatures are falling away, you hear this scene that goes dee da dee da dee da dee da, and for some reason everybody just went, that's really good. I went, oh, good, great. I'm really glad we've actually got something you like now. So it was kind of, there was this idea of the 4-note theme, and I could then use that. I suppose that was what was kind of reasonably original. That was one little building block of the score that worked in a lot of different places. You hear it in a lot of places. There was another one I did fairly early on when they met in the library for the first time, what they call the notes and queries cue. I wanted to come up with a theme for the book, which goes da-dee-da-dee, yeah? And you hear that when the book, that theme, I thought, okay, I was trying to think of a book, I was trying to think of a theme, because my thinking was Matthew and Diana are brought together by a book. Right. And then that book, now I was thinking, well, could I come up with a theme for the book that could then be developed in a dark way for when things are getting suspenseful? But could it become romantic? So I had this theme, da dee da dee. And the first thing I did was try and harmonize it in a really romantic way. And I put it over that scene, and half the people in the room liked it. And the other half said, no, it's too romantic. And it actually comes, the first time you really hear it is at the end of episode 2. I don't know if you've seen that yet. Have you seen episode 2? Well, if you look on the soundtrack, it's Why Magic Will Be Lost. And it's also there it also returns at the end when Sarah and Em say goodbye, and it's this kind of reverby piano theme within these really lush strings underneath it. So my point was that this was that I kind of came up with this idea. I like this theme, but it didn't end up being used in quite the way that I thought it would be. So when we came to do the library music the first time they met, I did this version, and the general consensus was that theme was good, but actually the nuance that they really wanted was it to be more tense and standoffish, that it was too romantic too soon. So we saved it. We didn't use it there. And this is how scores evolve. You know, you do version one, and then you come, and then you do version two, and you keep going until you come to some agreement about it. And that process goes on. Well, it can go on right the way through the dub. You know, people can still be moving and fiddling around with things to find the right balance. But certainly there was this wish, come up with a theme for the book, and come up with the sound of their relationship. You know, so in the end, the book, the in Notes and Queries, it went, for want of a better word, it went a bit more Philip Glass. I called it sort of vampire minimalism. It was this kind of dee-da-dee-da-dee-da, sort of a little bit more kind of undulating and uncertain. But then it had some romantic harmony in it, and it also had this distant voice that I was very keen on. But that, again, was quite a battle. You know, some people liked the voice. Some people thought it was too old-fashioned. Some people were very, very like, this is a contemporary show, and it's got to sound more contemporary. And I did have to persuade them, of course, that, you know, Matthew is technically 1,500 years old. You know, that he was like, he was with the Knights Templar. Why wouldn't you, I said, want to have something that feels a bit medieval at times? So you'll hear it when you go. You'll hear that the theme that I did gets kind of treated in different ways. And, for example, the use of wine glasses at the very beginning, the very first thing you hear is wine glasses, which for me was, for me, felt like the right sound for alchemy. It felt like the right sound for Diana's love of the history of science and alchemy.
Clinking wine glasses, or like playing wine glasses? Like,
well, the very first sound you hear is a big slam. Ding dong, ding dong, ding dong, ding dong, ding dong, and it's on wine, and it's just, you know, they're on wine glasses, they're samples. But the point I'm trying to get across is that the score, part of the problem of the challenge of the score was to try and mix old and new. I couldn't do it as a period drama score because the characters are now, they're set, it's in the modern day, they're living amongst us in the modern day. But also those characters have a long history, particularly in Matthew's case. They are of the past as well. Certainly Matthew is. So, you know, you can't treat Matthew just solely. You could do, but I felt it would be artistically wrong not to have a sense of time clinging to Matthew, you know, as it were.
Do you find there are any significant differences in the process between composing for film and composing for television?
I don't find it different, really. I think the challenges are always the same, which is the challenge is to try and find something that you feel at the end of the process, once you've got past the temp and you've had all the discussions, you want to reach this point where you look at it and you go, that music fits that picture. It could only really have been written for that picture, and hopefully there's something personal in it, and there's something interesting. You know, it's not just generic, and so that's I think that's there whether you write for TV or film. And it's interesting, like, I mean, I think one of my favorite pieces, the piece I'm most happy with, actually, is I don't know what track 16 or 17 is called, Origins, on the track, and there is like an example of minimalism that was kind of inflected by this kind of quite dare I say spiritual or churchy type sort of feel about it. And the whole point of it was just simply to, it just came out of the something that happens in episode two when Diana realizes that Matthew is very, very old. You know, she says, so you're about 500 years old, you know, and it's just like, I was just trying to create a sense of time passing, basically. And that's the solution I came up with. And, you know, that was probably the fifth or sixth version of that cue. I probably was tearing my hair out at that particular point, and then I finally came up with something that I liked and everybody else liked. So it's a struggle. It's a struggle which requires you to just keep going at it, whether it's film or TV. You just keep on. I describe it as trying to failing upwards, basically, you know, until you get somewhere that you like.
So you know this story really well. So my question is, have you read the books, or is this all knowledge from watching as you compose?
I hadn't read the books actually when I was brought on to do the show. And so obviously it's interesting to me to see how people that read it, that have read it, feel about the adaptation, because obviously that's very interesting, because, you know, I think when you read a book, you kind of make the film of the book in your own head. And you know, you've got a certain idea of what Matthew's going to look like, or Diana, and you know, so no, is the answer. I hadn't. I was very intrigued by it, but I hadn't read the books, and I was sort of sent the scripts, and then even then, to be honest, you know, whilst the script, it's great to read the scripts, you don't really get it until you see what people have made of the scripts. So, that was my process on that. How did you find? I mean, having watching it, how did it live up to what you sort of having? You know, did it differ from a lot from what you'd?
It's definitely an adaptation, but mm-hmm. I think it got the most important part of the soul of the series. You know what I mean? So I think that they've done a really good job with adaptation. Now, granted, we've only gotten because we saw the premiere at
All Souls Con.
So we've only seen the first episode, but...
Well, I mean, actually, I mean, I would say that the first episode was quite troubling in the sense of trying to get the story started. It actually really gets going, you know, and becomes even, you know, in my opinion, better and better from episode two. Because you get Juliet, you know, and so the other characters come in, and it really gets going.
Do you have a favorite character to score?
Oh,
tricky. I don't know. Actually, I did. I enjoyed all the. I enjoyed different. You know, I enjoyed. I think Matthew is particularly well acted. You know, by Matthew Good. I think that's he's really good. I enjoyed making Satu very scary, you know, all of them, you know, I wouldn't say I had a favorite, but if I had a favorite, it probably would be Matthew, the lead character. Yeah.
So looking at your background with not just your own training or, you know, training education as a child and coming up and experience in all those bands and then going back to composing school, to film and TV composition school, composing school.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Are there historical periods that you prefer to compose for, things that you're drawn to, or is there one that you like to do, but you haven't had the opportunity to compose?
It's funny, actually. I mean, I think most people who are in, like me, who are in film, TV, music, I think we probably relish the variety. And, you know, if you spent your whole career just doing action movies, or you only did romantic comedies, you would probably wish that you could do something else, you know. And it's, I think it's the variety of things that I really appreciate, because you get the chance to just, it's just new challenges. So I mean, there was a period in, I think I probably started out at a point when the BBC in particular was making quite a lot of period dramas. So I did some Dickens, I did Jane Eyre, I did Daniel Deronda, I did quite a few period dramas. And so I kind of really explored that genre quite a lot and really enjoyed it. But it was also great when you get the opportunity to do a really dark thriller that was only, you know, that's electronic. Or, I mean, last year I did a show about a biopic that was about a British actress called Barbara Windsor, and, you know, they wanted a jazz score for it. It was set during the 60s, And one of the things it needed was to be quite jazzy. And it's like, great, I can do that for 6 weeks. You know, I'm kind of in jazz mode for 6 weeks. And then the next thing, I'm in vampire mode for 8 months. You know, so it's kind of, you know, and you would want then a break from that and to do something new. So I think it's the variety that I really enjoy.
Speaking of the discovery of witches, vampire writing, does that mean you've signed on for future seasons?
I hope so. I mean, they are making season two. They are starting in March, and I hope I'll be asked. I mean, they're all very happy with the score, so there's a good reason to expect that I will be. It'd be great to carry on. But you never know. You know, you never know quite what is in the minds of producers. But I think there's probably a good chance that I'll be doing season two.
Yay!
So
all around. Unless they suddenly decide, I mean, you know, like season two goes back to the Elizabethan period, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Yes.
So it's gonna be interesting to see, okay, so how do you do that? Because, you know, Sky, one of the things that was quite tricky was that the production company were aware that, you know, they were more receptive to my argument that you had to have a mixture of old and new. Yeah. You know, that even we're just talking in the use of, like, for some people, using strings, using voice, using wine glasses, that's old fashioned. Okay. Not for me, but for some people, they think, no, I want it to sound like a Quentin Tarantino movie. I want records. I want a hip hop score. Yeah. And much as you might want to explain to them that you just don't think that works, that could be somewhat what they're wanting. And certainly, Sky's feeling about the music was that initially it was quite tricksy, because their feeling was, well, this is Sky, we shouldn't sound like anything like network TV, which is an interesting challenge. But it's like, but we've still got a vampire that's 1500 years old. I'm not gonna do him as a kind of, I'm not gonna put a rock score on him just because you want him to be, I don't think that would be right. I don't think it would be literate. I don't think it would be, I think it would be too anachronistic. So, you know, but it's an interesting challenge. And because people want their scores, they want the show to stand out. Fundamentally, they want it to stand out. So if that means being anachronistic, they don't care. Whereas as a film composer, I do care. You know, I think that it's very hard. It's hard to get the right balance. Yeah, you know, and the right balance between old scores, old fashioned Hollywood scores, and modern contemporary scores. You know, I do like the old fashioned virtues of, you know, harmony and complex sounds, and, you know, but every now and again, somebody comes up with a modern way of doing something that excites everybody. And then people go, well, why can't we have that on a period drama? So, you know, it could be that at the start of season two, people go, okay, look, we're in the first conversation that will be had is, okay, I know we're in Tudor England, but the last thing I want to hear is any Tudor instrument. You know, it will literally be, and so it will be, okay, right. So what are we in? Well, what are we doing then? Are we doing synths? You know, why should it necessarily be electronic? Why can't it be? Why can't there be some interesting? Like, I mean, I did a score for a show called Elizabeth, which was about Elizabeth I, and I chose to do quite a traditional score using period instruments, and it was the right thing to do. I didn't get fashionable about it. I did what I thought was right for the story, and. So, you know, the problem is you're kind of up against different things of taste and so on. So I'll give you an example. You know, if you think about Hans Zimmer's score for Gladiator, it was beautifully done, a beautiful mixture of big orchestral stuff. And then there was quite modern programming in there, quite modern drumming, but it also had world instruments and guitar and so on. Okay, so here's an interesting thing. So when they came to do 300, I reckon what they were thinking was, okay, well, we want the grandeur of Gladiator, but it needs to be more kick-ass, yeah? And somebody found a way to introduce thrash metal, right, into what is essentially a period piece. But maybe they could do it because it was slightly comic book. like, you know, so they had, you know, all that sort of thrash metal guitar worked brilliantly. But then what you'll get is somebody going, okay, well then every time we have this, when we do a show about the Spartans or something, we can have thrash metal. And it's like, no, you can have thrash metal if it's kind of comic book or whatever, but you can't have it without the wailing voice that goes over the top, because otherwise what you've done is turn the show into a sort of ridiculous music video. So I think the kind of to-ing and fro-ing, the back and forth between we want it new, but we also want it old and familiar. So, like, you know, we don't want Harry Potter because that's kind of, well, A, that's Harry Potter, and we want to say something new. What have you got that's new? But, you know, is the answer is I haven't reinvented the wheel with the score. But what I've tried to do is kind of just be as interesting as I can be within the bounds of the genre. So, you know, I think you'd hate it if I went rock guitar all over that opening. I mean, I think that would sound rubbish, personally, right? But at the same time, there's got to be, if you think about scoring now, no, the films that we see now do not sound like the films that Hollywood put out in the 1940s, you know? We don't sound like those. We don't sound like shows that were done in the 80s when they went very synthy, you know? So film music is constantly evolving, and there's always this kind of discussion about what is fresh versus what is familiar, and that's constantly the dialogue that you're having in your own head as well. You know, I want to be fresh, but at the same time, I've got to serve the picture in a way that isn't ridiculous.
It sounds like part of, you already addressed this, but I want to go back to it. It sounds like while taking, speaking of cues, while taking definite nods and cues from the production team and you through the temps, and you respecting, which communicates to you something very important. It gives you at least an idea of kind of what they're going for, even if it's not where they end up. And it allows you to say, okay, this is what they're feeling. And then you have that back and forth, you said. It's definitely a journey. Do you find yourself in that journey, especially if you feel very strongly about something that is not lined up with what they kind of provided in a temp or even any version of a temp? Do you find that from yourself, part of your job as composer and in this journey is as educator?
Yeah, I mean, it's like, you know, I mean, one of the producers on this show, it was great. She sort of said to me, music isn't my specialist subject, you know? So I'm sort of, I don't know. A lot of people will find it quite hard to say what it is that they like. And, you know, they're kind of feeling their way. And so they are basically reliant on the composer to kind of, you know, bring a point of view. You know, bring something to it, bring something interesting. But at the same time, yes, you are cajoling. Sometimes you're even pleading and saying, "Look, I can't do. It's not going to get better than this." Occasionally, I mean, you hope you won't have that conversation. But there are some cues that can kind of bring, particularly at the start of things, that can bring really, you know, you spend ages and ages on things. I mean, one, you know, and then suddenly the tension dissipates and everyone's kind of happy. So I would say we spent half the schedule on the first two episodes, and then I had to write the other six in the other half of the schedule. So, you know, and that's kind of what happens. Everybody angsts and angsts about episode one until finally people sort of agree, and then they relax a bit. I mean, one of the ones that was quite funny was there's a song when we were in the very opening, which I'm quite pleased seems to be quite popular with on iTunes. It's called Song of Home, and it goes into Ashmole 782. Now, this is interesting because, and this is one thing to say is I was glad of my background playing in bands here, because I wrote that song for them because they couldn't find another song that worked. You know, the feeling was in the first part of the show, originally they were thinking, oh, well, maybe we can have like an overture for 3 minutes, right? That goes, introduces Matthew on the bridge and then introduces Diana, you know, right up to the point where she gets to the Ashmolean, to the Bodleian Library. Yeah, it was about the first 3 minutes. So we tried that, I tried that and so on. And then people said, oh, no, I think no, that's not, we want something else. So we'll have the Matthew bit at the beginning, and then we want a song. And of course, everybody goes away and puts songs on there. And usually it's songs that are just because of some lyrical relationship, some often quite banal lyrical relationship. So they tried David Bowie's Absolute Beginners, because in a way, you know, Diana is an absolute beginner. And a couple of people liked it and more people didn't like it. And then they tried Pressure by Queen, because she's kind of under pressure. You know, and it's like, and then there was a very straightforward technical thing in that sequence, which meant that no song was working. And the problem is, what's happening is, you want to start it when she's walking through the quad, she's getting ready. So it's like she's getting ready for her day, but right in the middle of that day, right in the middle of getting ready, there's a long look at a photograph of her parents. And if you don't get the distinction between what she feels in her working day and the feeling that she gets, then that's it. That sequence doesn't really work. So in the end, I said, okay, I'll have a go. I'll write you a song that starts reasonably upbeat and then sort of deepens and becomes more emotional on the photograph. And that's exactly what I did. So I did, you know, I did a piece. I was actually hoping that the song would be treated like a song and just played normally. But in the end, they decided to put the first half of it through a radio, which I didn't particularly like, but they did it. And what they decided in the end was that the song becomes real, if you like, halfway through the photographs. So if you look at it, it starts as radio, and then when she's looking at the picture of her parents, and then the song kind of blooms into life. And that song was, I wrote that, you know, lyrically and musically for that particular thing. It's the first time I've done it in a long time. I've actually just written the song. So it was kind of written in the kind of feeling of a sort of female singer-songwriter, a little bit Civil Wars-ish, a bit, you know, I don't know, stuff that's just been going around my head. And then I wrote some lyrics about feeling home, about missing home, but also specifically feeling ambivalent about home, you know. So, you know, and this is all very, very deliberate, because Diana is feeling homesick and yet she's kind of wanting to get away from her. She's, you know, she's standing on the verge of something new and exciting. So I wrote this song, hopefully not too corny, but, you know, just that literally just summed up. It was absolutely written for that sequence, because they couldn't find a song that worked. So I decided to take on the task.
I feel like that song, because it segues into the Ashmole 782, I feel like I'm cheated out of that song, because I feel like there was more of that song and I wanted to hear how it ended.
You are so correct. Because given the rush to write it, me and the singer, Clara Catalars, we just had to deliver the first minute and a half. And it is unsatisfying. I totally agree. I mean, we have plans to do a longer version, but it's slightly tricky because we're not quite sure how we would. We're not signed recording artists. I totally agree with you. I think it would sound much better at 3 minutes. But it's an example of it was written for a sequence that was already edited, and it was only, so the idea was whatever song they put in there in the past was always going to be jolted out with a load of reverb when she drops her books on the floor. So you were always going to be cheated out of an extended play through. Do you see what I mean? So when I came to make up the soundtrack library, the soundtrack, I originally thought I can't put this on there because it's unsatisfactorily only a minute and a half. And then I thought, well, people like it, so I think I should just put it on there and I'll have it segue into the next cue. And at least people get a little blast of it. But I agree with you. If we'd had time, we would have recorded a longer version just for the CD, but that, I'm afraid, we didn't have time at that point.
I'm slightly mollified.
Okay, I'm glad you're happier. Maybe we'll try and release it next time.
We'll call it the summer cut.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
So I know we're winding down, but one of the things that I find the most interesting, my first degree I went to music school, and it was is in classical vocal performance. And so okay. I was right there along with clarinetists, you know, pianists, all the different instruments. And so I always found when we were taking theory classes and being instructed, of course, you have to be careful or be very careful not to do it, / if you're going to do it, there has to be a good reason for it. And that is dissonance, one of the strongest tools of any composer. Do you have a preference for dissonance? Do you try to avoid it? Is it something that you use carefully?
I think it's very interesting. That's a really good question. I personally love dissonance. And I am always trying to get more in than other people want.
Oh, wow.
And in a way, which is, as you watch the show, you will obviously hear quite a lot of things which are quite dissonant because bad stuff is happening to people. You know, so the witch wind, for example, the witch wind cue has a lot of threat and dissonance in it. And I think it's absolutely important that dissonance is used, because without it's like yin and yang. How can you have release into consonance if you don't have some dissonance? You know, the two things are constantly going, oscillating between tension and release in music. It's a cliche, but it's true. You know, so at the same time, I would say that the fashion these days is, I find that scores are a lot less dissonant than they used to be. I'm not sure why that is. I think there's a lot of chords and stuff that I quite like to use, dissonant chords, which I find I have a struggle getting past people because they don't want to feel that, even though the story is very dissonant at that point. You know, I mean, you should feel there should be some scary stuff in this show, you know. There's a very dissonant cue, like when, if you check, Matthew murdered, track 6 is extremely dissonant. I noticed that doesn't have any popularity on iTunes at the moment. No one's buying that one. But it's kind of, you know, the guy's been bitten and it's a very dark moment. And it's like you wouldn't score that with a kind of nice, happy chord, I feel. And it's funny, people will accept a lot of dissonance in horror films, you know. In fact, an awful lot of very interesting music is written for horror films, in my opinion, because horror films allow you to be dissonant. But in a lot more mainstream TV and film, people are very nervous about it. So, yeah, I would say it's a crucial tool. Because I think it's a color that, you know, you need to use, because stories have moments of great dissonance. And, you know, if you're going to try and create a sense of threat and add to the sense of threat around Diana from the different kind of species and you know, then you need threatening music. So hence the use of dissonance.
Well, thank you so much, Mr. Rob Lane. This has been a treasure. We're just so happy that you agreed to chat with us and to share about yourself as well as your experience with composing in general, but specifically with the soundtrack to A Discovery of Witches. Is there anything you can share with us about any upcoming projects that you can talk about?
Well, I've started a new show for BBC Two called Mother, Father, Son that stars Richard Gere in his first TV role for many a year, playing a press baron, an American press baron who has a son running, rather like Rupert Murdoch, running one of his newspapers in London. And it also has Helen McCrory as his estranged ex-wife. And it's an 8-part series about the relationship between these three people, mother, father, son. And again, it's taking me in a very different direction from witches. So I've got a whole new challenge ahead of me.
Well, excellent. We can't wait for our friends and fans other fans and friends in the UK who will, of course, have slightly easier access to it.
When does a discovery of witches, when is it viewable in America?
We don't have a date, but we have, they have told us early 2019.
Okay. Oh, I'm sorry. You have to wait so long.
No.
Yeah. Oh, we're also sorry. It's okay, though.
Well, as far as I know, series two is definitely happening. So that will be, I think they're starting to shoot that next March, 2019. So I would have thought that would probably be ready sometime in the autumn of next year.
Wow. So that'll be a year.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, thank you so much for spending some of your very, very valuable time with us. And
it's a pleasure. It's a pleasure.
Letting us know a little bit behind the scenes.
Fantastic. Yeah. It's been a pleasure talking to you.
Oh, it's been our absolute pleasure. And we would love, if the opportunity presents itself, to have you back again once, either maybe if we have huge questions for you once the series is out and we have questions about choices, then we might bug you. And then of course,
no, please feel free.
Once the next soundtrack comes out.
I mean, we're music nerds. Yeah, so
we're kind of music. We both have been performing since we were in the single digits and
fantastic.
We're not experts, but we do hear things. So
you like your music and that's good.
Oh yes. Yes.
Great. Very much. Well, give me a buzz anytime. We can talk again.
Beautiful.
We'll do so. Okay. Thank you so much. And be well and best of luck with everything you're working on.
Thank you very much. Take care. Bye now.
Thank you.
Thank you. You too. Bye-bye.
Bye.